So in preparing for this time, I realized I'm speaking to mostly couples, and I'm a single guy. And so I thought, well, that's interesting. And so I searched far and wide for some counsel that I can pass along. I'm a single guy. I don't really understand your world, but I found something from a gentleman by the name of Red Skelton. Some of you older people might know Red. He's a very quirky skeleton, very quirky comedian. So I'm going to share with you as I go through the week. If today kind of works, I'll keep going with this for the rest of the week. If not, we'll find something else. But this is the perfect, the recipe for the perfect marriage. So from Red, if you want to write this down. Number one, 2 times a week we go to a nice restaurant, have a little beverage, good food, and companionship. She goes on Tuesdays, I go on Fridays. Number two, we also sleep in separate beds. Hers is in California and mine is in Texas. So I thought those were fun. Well, very excited to be with you this week and share what the Lord's been saying to me about our topic, giving your life to God. And as we kick off this morning, we're going to look at the first step at giving your life to God. As I mentioned last night, we first have to get to know Him and enter into a relationship with Him. After all, how can you give your life to someone who you don't know? So I'm going to share my story with you, how I entered into a relationship with God. That'll give you some important context as we go through the week, as I talk about other things, because as I mentioned last night, I'm going to share a lot with you just about my journey as it intersects with the Scripture. So you can sit back, relax. You probably don't need to take many notes around this. I'm just going to share my story with you. I grew up in an idyllic small town outside of New York City, Rye, New York, right on the water. Dad worked in New York City, took the train in, and it was a great place to grow up. Great schools, the kind of place where I could ride my bike anywhere in town. Does that even exist anymore? Not in my world, in Atlanta, for sure. I'm the second of 4 children. I have an older brother, a younger brother, and a younger sister. And the way I would describe myself growing up, shy, introverted, and self-conscious. And I would describe myself still the same way today. I'm from a traditional family. Dad worked for a big oil company. And we did move around quite a bit before we settled in Rye, New York. Never lived in Houston, but he worked for one of the major oil companies. We were in Europe, we were in different parts of the US. So he was with the same company his whole career. And he went to work every day, put on the suit. Mom stayed at home, took care of the family, was an incredible mom and homemaker. My dad was my role model. He excelled in sports and business. And he was just very successful at everything he did. He was an amazing baseball player. In fact, he had an opportunity to play professional baseball. And I grew up playing baseball. I just thought, oh my gosh, my dad was offered a contract with the New York Giants. Got to play in the polo fields, meet all these great players. I really looked up to Dad, and he motivated me to achieve and to perform in school and in sports. And Mom was a perfect mom, incredibly nurturing, and really showed me what love was all about. Growing up, I knew that God was real, but I didn't make any genuine effort to get to know Him. After all, He might want me to go to Africa, right? We attended church pretty much every Sunday. My parents both had leadership roles, but church really wasn't that meaningful. It was more just, kind of part of our image is the way it seemed. And I remember going through something they call the confirmation process. And I had no interest in really learning about that stuff or genuinely engaging. And just to give you an idea of where my heart was, they gave us a final exam at the end of this, 6-8 weeks, whatever it was. And I cheated on the final exam. I had mastered the art of the crib sheet in going to school. And man, I used that crib sheet in a great way. I got 105 on that final exam. Very sad. Overall, church and religion were just a very empty, meaningless experience for me. So I look back overall, I had a great upbringing. I was from a good family. It's very, very fortunate. A good, stable home. We had everything that we needed. And growing up, I learned to perform. I performed well in school. I performed well in sports. But I guess that just wasn't enough for me. I wanted more, and I started looking for more. And by the time I got to high school, I was living two lives. I lived a public compliant life, and the way that looked, you know, from a good family in this great small town, going to church, a good student, I was athletic, I seemed to do well in all the sports I was in, baseball, golf, soccer. Soccer was where I excelled the most. And I had a great coach, and this guy, he was a taskmaster, and he was a brilliant soccer coach, and he brought out the best in me. He also gave me a nickname, which really stuck. Actually, two nicknames. One nickname was Gumby, you know, that tall, lean, pliable character. And the other name, a little bit more to the point, was Praying Mantis. I mean, I was really thin, and, you know, a traditional soccer player is kind of, you know, shorter, stocky, muscular. I had no business excelling in soccer, but this guy taught me the game, and I really listened and I learned, and I got good enough where my senior year they voted me to be a co-captain of the team, and our team went to the New York State Championship game, where we lost, but still it was incredible to be a part of a team like that. So that was just an example of my drive to excel, and it was a lot of fun along the way. So that was my public life. Looks pretty good, doesn't it? Well, then there was this whole other life. I had this secret rebellious life going on. And the best way to describe that is to think back on the feelings that I remember having. Not very good. First, there was a lot of hurt and anger in me. And that was mainly focused towards my dad. I craved my dad's love and his attention. And his dad was a perfectionist. And his love and attention, it always hinged on doing more. A perfectionist, you just never get there. If you ever say to someone, are you a perfectionist? Well, not quite. It's like, it's kind of the point. You could never get there. And I could never please dad, and I could never hit the bar. It was always good, but not good enough. Here's how you need to do better. And that hurt. And over time, I think some anger and rebellion started to seep out of me. Obviously, I'm responsible for that. It's not an excuse, but that's kind of the environment I grew up in. So there was hurt and anger. Secondly, guilt and shame. And I'd say the main wellspring of that, I discovered pornography when I was around 12 years old and started to feast on that, and it ignited lust in me that became like a fire that I couldn't contain. This is something I don't talk about with or in front of women, but with guys I tell them, and we'll share with you ladies, that to me, I feel like I set a world record for masturbation growing up. I didn't realize it was something as I got older that guys really struggle with, and I discovered that women struggle with it too. But that was the main outlet for this fire that was spreading inside of me. The thing with a lust like that is you're never satisfied, always needing more as that fire would spread. And as I got older, I started to have perverse thoughts and desires that I knew were wrong, that led to even deeper levels of shame. So hurt and anger, guilt and shame, and then I was lonely. I wouldn't describe myself that way back then, but just looking back on it, I know I was lonely, because I mean, I had friends, but I couldn't talk to anyone about these things going on in my life. I wouldn't even know how to put words to it. I didn't have real intimacy in relationship. And then there was fear. I was afraid of being exposed, that people might find out that, you know, this secret part of my life. I was afraid of the bullies at school. I had some guys who would slam me into the locker, or, you know, demand my lunch money or whatever, and just kind of went through school afraid of bumping into one of those guys. I hated that. And being a skinny kid, I didn't have what it took. I didn't have the courage to stand up to them. I was also afraid of the dark. I was afraid of going to bed at night. I thought that there would be a murderer under my bed or in my closet who was going to get me. My bedroom was down in the basement level. And I was literally afraid going through high school around that. So that was the secret rebellious life. As I got into eighth and ninth grade, I got into drinking, which was followed by smoking pot. And once I got into college, other recreational drugs followed. the party life for me became another fire that started to spread in my life. And looking back, I can see that I was trying to run away from the issues in my life through that whole party scene. And really, I thought, if you weren't drinking and playing around with some drugs, man, you were a loser. It's like, you're missing out on all the fun, right? That was my mindset that I had. So I didn't know any different. And once I got to college, I was a binge drinker, drinking excessively 3 to 4 times a week, many of those times ending up with me drinking and driving, of me throwing up from drinking too much, blacking out, or some combination of all of those. And this lifestyle led me into some pretty dark places. Just to give you an example, the first time that I had sex with a woman was with a prostitute. The second time, I was high on cocaine. The saddest thing is, I never considered that there was anything wrong with that or with my lifestyle. For college, I attended Colgate University, and I adopted the mantra, work hard, play hard. Colgate was a strong academic school, but also a big party school that revolved around the fraternity system. And my work hard, play hard mantra fit right in there. After college, I got a job at a big advertising agency, which was kind of a dream for me. I worked there for 2 years, but they didn't promote me fast enough. And so I left, and I enrolled at Duke to get an MBA, so I could move ahead faster. Just the drive, the ambition, and I was working on a great piece of business there. I worked on the Marine Corps account. You know, we're looking for a few good men. And that was a really neat thing to be a part of. And I talked to the guy in charge of the office, and wanted to be promoted, be moved to another office, you know, London or New York or something, and he said no, and I said, all right, I'm out of here. At Duke, I had a great experience there, got a great education, and met some really neat guys. We all got into the intramurals together and had some great teams. They gave me an interesting nickname, which I think kind of sums up a lot of my experience there at Duke. The nickname that they gave me was Lucifer. I wore that as a badge of honor. I thought that's pretty cool. I didn't even make the connection to this idea of Satan, you know? I just thought, man, that's pretty cool. But as I look back on it, I can see that they saw this Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde side of me, the guy who could show up for class and have it together and do well, but then, you know, here comes the party scene, you get some alcohol in me, and this whole other person comes out. My time at Duke was really a great experience, but it did not end very well. It's a 2-year full-time program, and I remember coming back to campus from Christmas, and I was there working away. It was a very cold January night, which was unusual in Durham, North Carolina, and I got a phone call from my older brother, which was even more unusual. And he called to tell me something that was devastating. Have you ever gotten a phone call or just a piece of news and like life changes from that moment? It's never the same. Well, this was my phone call. And what my brother told me was something that was so hard to believe. I mean, it's like you could tell me anything but this and I'd believe it. And what he told me was that my father was leaving my mother for another woman. I never thought my dad would be capable of something like that. He was my role model. He was the person I was striving to become like. I thought he was an upstanding person of character. And all of a sudden, what? I mean, how can that be possible? It's like I had been living in a bubble, and the bubble got popped in that moment. I didn't know what to do. I put on my winter coat and I just walked around in the apartment community where I lived, just kind of like a zombie. I remember coming back to my room and laying down on my bed and just put my head in the pillow. I just cried like a little boy. And I thought to myself, if I ever needed God, it's right now. And I don't have a clue who God is. Just all by myself like that. And the way I felt about it, you know, it was this very cold night, a wintry storm, and there were these big icicles growing off the gutter right outside my window. And I felt like one of those icicles just got plunged into my heart. I didn't know how to respond to that, but I thought to myself, I don't know what a midlife crisis is, but maybe that's what Dad's going through. And so I called the family meeting. I thought, surely Dad's going to snap out of this and we'll kind of get back to normal. So I initiated this meeting, and my siblings and I, we all gathered at my parents' house in Virginia. And we had this meeting, and I remember Dad standing up and demonstrating zero regret or remorse, and pretty much saying, this is what I'm doing. I thought, wow. I remember sitting down with Dad in his office in the house to talk about this one-on-one. And he was resolved that this is where he was going. And I said to him a couple things. I said, Dad, I want you to promise me one thing. I said, will you promise me that you won't kill yourself? It's the only logical thing, conclusion I could come to, is when Dad realizes what he's done, that would be the only logical thing to do, would be to kill yourself. And he broke down crying. I've never seen him cry like that before. The other thing I said to him was, Dad, if this woman is so fantastic that you're basically flushing your family down the toilet, I'd like to meet her. And my siblings heard about that idea, and they said, yeah, we do too. We want to meet her. And so Dad arranged for us to meet with Sandy. We went to her apartment and sat down. And the one thing I remember from that conversation was towards the end, I said to her, and one important fact, Sandy is 2 years older than I am. Okay, she's 29 years younger than Dad. Dad was nearing retirement. And she worked for him at this company in her 20s. And I said, Sandy, have you considered that pretty soon Dad's going to be an old man and you're going to be in your prime? And her response was, it's love. This is love. What do you say to that, right? So all this happened in my last semester at Duke. A time when I, should just be hitting my stride and launching out into the future. Well, some of that happened and some of it didn't. I was interviewing for jobs, and I landed, actually I had two job offers when I graduated. One was to work for Coke, and one was to work for Pepsi. And I went to Plano, Texas. I was actually working at Frito-Lay. And I went to Plano, Texas, and my conclusion was, if I come to work here, I'm going to become an alcoholic. I probably was already an alcoholic. But all they seemed to do was drink margaritas, and I thought, yeah, I can't see this. And in contrast, Atlanta, I love the outdoors, the trees, and working for Coke. Plus, they made me an offer I could not refuse. They said, we want you to work on the Coca-Cola business. And that was something that I could not pass up. As a marketing person, they wanted me to work on the number one brand in the world, the Coca-Cola brand. So I said, I'll be there. So I graduated, which was interesting, because if there was one person I would like to be at my graduation, it was my dad, and I didn't even invite him. The relationship just was really broken. But I moved to Atlanta and started to work for Coke in what was a truly dream job. It's in the brand management group, working on the Coca-Cola brand. And just, any of you remember the New Coke debacle many years ago? Okay, I see a lot of heads nodding. Younger people, you have to look on the internet. So Coca-Cola withdrew their great brand and replaced it with something called New Coke. And the country was up in arms and went nuts over that and demanded Coke bring back the original formula. And they did, with great fanfare. And I got to the company 3 years after that event. And they said to me, okay, Mr. MBA, we've got all kinds of data for 3 years on what's happened. We want you to analyze it all and tell us what happened. I thought, man, what an assignment. So I did that, put it together, presented, and I started presenting up the ranks, lots of management ranks at Coca-Cola. And after 9 months being in the company, I was in front of the chief marketing officer reporting on some of my conclusions. So I hit the fast track right away in this company. What an irony, though, to be doing so well professionally and yet at the low point in my life personally. My heart was filled with hurt, anger, and sadness. But I knew nothing else except work hard, play hard, so I just kept doing it, right? And now I brought the party to Atlanta and the Coca-Cola Company. But after a little over 2 years there, this anger and all this stuff inside of me just kept leaking out. I remember one time walking through a part of Atlanta with some friends. And we had, we were drinking a lot. And my dad loved Mercedes, and there was a Mercedes convertible with the top down. I just threw my beer all over that car. Just an example of kind of the Lucifer. I mean, I would just do stuff like that and get away with it most of the time. Got away with it that night. So, but after about 2 years, I knew I needed some help with this anger leaking out of me, and Coke invited me to go on a leadership development retreat. And it was basically a bunch of psychiatrists meeting with us and talking to us, trying to give us some idea of self-awareness, what's going on inside of you. And I never experienced anything quite like that. And in that time, it was very meaningful for me. And one particular thing happened. They had us laying on the floor doing a guided meditation with some nice music and, you know, things you're afraid of and all kinds of stuff like that. It was wonderful. But in that time, it's like God opened up my mind, and I just kind of got this glimpse that there's a spiritual side to life. Never really considered that before, but it's like he just kind of opened up my mind. There's this spiritual dimension, and I realize I know nothing about it, but he just gave me this glimpse where all of a sudden I realized that's where life is really all about. It's like God's grace just kind of parted my eyes a little bit to get a glimpse of that, and I became curious. I went back to, back to Coke after that, kept working, but one of the counselors from them came to Coke every month in case you wanted some follow-up. Man, I was all over his calendar. And he was very helpful to me, and he really helped me to see how self-oriented I was in my life. And one day, just to illustrate that, he said, Rob, I want to teach you a new word. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. What's that? He said, the word is others. And I didn't really get it, but he just, as we talked about it, he said, Rob, do you have any real, engagement with people where it's just not about you? Well, what about my friends? we talked about that. It's like, I guess that's really all about me. How about my family? That's really all about me. He helped me to see that I really didn't know anything about others. It was totally about self. And that hit me like a brick. And I just realized in the moment, I need to make some changes. And right there, I decided I'm going to stop the party scene completely. And I did. And I talked to him about, how do I learn about this whole others deal? And he suggested, why don't you do some volunteering? Pick something that you really don't want to do. I mean, it's not in it for you, where you're going to go have fun, where you've got to make a commitment and be there a certain amount of time, for at least a year. So that scared me to death. But I said, okay, I got to learn this. I did it. Signed up to be a big brother. But the hardest thing that he talked to me about that I did was forgiving my father. Now remember, at this stage of my life, I just have this little glimpse that there's a spiritual side of life, but I have no interest in God, no understanding of God. But he just reasoned with me. He said, Rob, your bitterness has you consumed. It's like you're in a cage, but you've got the key in your hand. And to get out of that cage, you just need to forgive. And he reasoned with me. He was like, okay, I think that's it. And so I did. It's the hardest thing I've ever done was forgiving my dad. And that's a whole other story. We haven't talked for 2 years when I called him and said, Dad, it's been 2 years, but we need to talk. And we got together and I forgave him. And that was a huge thing. And I got out of that cage in some respect. So I had all these changes, but there still was no peace. All this career success, forgiveness, learning about others, stopping the party, and still no peace. I knew there was more. It's like this story has not ended. I just knew there was more, and I was determined to find it. But right about that time, I had one friend. By the way, my friends, when I stopped partying, they were gone like roaches in the light. But during that friend, I had one time, and he was starting to reconsider life a little bit. And he had started to find answers in the Bible. And that was a new thing to me. I grew up going to church, but that, as I mentioned, that didn't mean anything. So I was like, in the Bible, and I was like, yeah, right, whatever. Let me tell you about what my counselor's telling me about, fear and others and whatnot. Well, my friend and others that I met through him told me something that I had never heard before. They claimed to have a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. You know, a relationship with God through Jesus. And frankly, that was really hard for me to believe. I mean, I knew that Jesus was dead. How can you have a relationship with a dead man? I guess that's something they just say in the Bible Belt, you know? I was very, you know, on guard about being in the Bible Belt. You know, these people can be a little different, some of them. But I found myself curious because these people clearly had something that I didn't have. I saw peace in these people, and they genuinely loved me and cared for me. So I started to read the Bible with a genuine interest to understand, who is this person, Jesus Christ? And does he have anything for me? And as I read, I was just drawn into his life. I'd never heard of anyone like this. And I was challenged, too, to live better, that there was a better way. And 1 year after I started reading the Bible, I was at a weekend retreat in the Georgia mountains with a church group that I started to hang around. And they had a speaker, his name was Kelly. And what I learned from Kelly that weekend, in combination with what I had been learning as I had been reading the Bible, kind of added up to give me a message that really changed my life. Let me try to sum it up. I learned that I did have a basic problem. It's not what I thought it was, though. My basic problem was sin. And this is something that we all struggle with. It's a part of the human condition. And there's a consequence. Because of sin, I was separated from God. Separated, and yet God loved me anyway and wanted to help me overcome that separation. I learned that Jesus was a great teacher. He was a miracle worker. He healed people of all kinds of diseases and blindness. He even raised people from the dead. He was constantly helping people with their struggles and giving them hope. And he made an outrageous claim. He claimed to be the Son of God. He lived a perfect life, but the religious leaders of his time did not believe or understand how he could be the Son of God. So they arrested him, and they arranged for him to be killed in the most painful, horrible way. They nailed him to a cross. And they left him there to suffer and die. And he died. He suffered things we can't even imagine. He died, he was buried, but 3 days later, after he was killed, he proved that he was in fact the Son of God by rising from the dead. And this is something that had been written down hundreds of years earlier, that all this would happen in explicit detail. There were over 500 eyewitnesses that saw him after he rose from the dead. And many of them personally talked to him and even ate food with him. That was the core of the message that Kelly shared with us on Saturday. Saturday was a full day, and I was ready to go to bed. But Sunday morning came around, and somewhere like around 5 o'clock or something, I woke up and my wheels were just spinning. And I was thinking about what this guy had talked about the day before. Another cold January morning. I don't know what it is with being cold Januarys. But I just had to get up and do something. And it's in North Georgia, and up in the Georgia mountains. So don't think Rockies, okay? Think more like foothill type mountains. But there was a mountain. And I put on my boots and my coat, and I started hiking up this mountain, thinking about what I had heard the day before and just what I had been learning in my life. Going up these switchbacks behind our cabin and thinking about Jesus and how he related to me. And as I went, I wanted this personal relationship with God and the peace that I sought my new friends. I really wanted that, but how do I get there? And as I walked up the mountain that morning, it's like there was a puzzle, and yet the pieces all of a sudden started to come together for me. And as I got to the top of that mountain, I had this understanding all of a sudden that I wanted this personal relationship, and yet the issue was my sin. It was blocking me from that relationship. And in that moment, this mysterious bright light, like a beam, hit me in the face. And it was only on me. I looked around, and it was dark everywhere. And there was this beam of light And I just knew that I was in the presence of God. It was as if Jesus himself was standing there right in front of me, like this, just open arms, ready to receive me. And all of a sudden, I just realized that all of this was true, that I've been learning, that Jesus really was alive, that he really died for my sins, that he wanted to forgive me in spite of what an absolute, complete wretch. I was just completely overcome by his love and his acceptance. And I know this is a weird thing to try to describe. I can't really even explain what happened that morning. I don't fully understand it. But I knew I was in his presence, and I just fell to the ground, kind of like what you read about in the Bible. I just fell to the ground in front of him, and it was a very emotional thing. And I just remember just receiving that love for me and letting him wash away all this sin. When I stood up, it was light everywhere. There was no more darkness. And I walked down that mountain, and for the first time, I had peace. My soul was at rest. I was 30 years old, and for the first time in my life, I experienced peace. Life went on. The next day, I went back to Coca-Cola, but I started to realize that things had changed. This Jesus now was with me. I was in Christ, and as a forgiven person, I was a new creation. Paul writes in 2 Corinthians 5:17, "Therefore, if anyone is in Christ, he is a new creation. The old is gone, and the new has come." As a new creation, as time went on, I saw more and more changes in me, and most of these unfolded slowly. But I just want to give you three examples as I look back. First of all, that word "others" from my counselor. Remember that word that he taught me? Well, God helped me to start loving others. First, the big other, him. He gave me a love for him. And he helped me to start loving other people too. And that self-life that had been at the center of my world started to change, and Lucifer started to die. As I mentioned, I had forgiven my father before I accepted Christ, but I still had a lot of hurt and pain, and the relationship was difficult. Dad divorced Mom, married Sandy, and my relationship with Dad and Sandy, it was a struggle. But over time, God started to heal my hurt and my anger and replace it with his love. He changed my heart so I could begin to love and honor my father, and in time, his new wife. Never saw that coming, for Dad to actually help me to start loving and honoring Sandy. That's a big deal. I'm going to talk more about that later in the week. So the whole others thing was one big change. Another big change was in my work life and all that selfish ambition. My life had been mainly one of performance and selfish ambition, as I've described. Getting ahead, moving up as fast as possible. But after meeting Jesus, that started to change. I even wondered, should I leave Coca-Cola and do some sort of full-time ministry? I could not believe what I had experienced and what I had learned and how God was working in me. Gee, maybe I should get out of corporate America. So I prayed about that, and the Lord said to me, "You stay right where you are. This is a dark place, and I need for my light to be there, and my light is in you now. Be a light in the darkness." So I learned to follow Jesus in corporate America and to serve him, and I learned to start sharing my faith. It was a huge deal. How do you do that in corporate America? Even harder today. I noticed that my passion for God and his kingdom started to increase, and my excitement and my drive in my job started to decrease. And 3.5 years after I met Jesus, God clearly told me to leave Coca-Cola. And that's a whole other story that I'm also going to get into later in the week. When he told me to leave, he did not tell me what to do next. The only direction he gave me was, I want you to have margin in your life. I had little margin. He said, I want you to have margin in your life for others. And I want you to have time to reach out to people who don't know me. And I want you to have margin to disciple men. That's the only direction he gave me. So I left with no job. And soon thereafter, I started meeting with Tom and discipling him. And I did leave with some financial cushion, so I didn't have to work right away. I actually thought maybe I would do some, I did some writing, and I wondered if that could become a vocational option. And I wrote, and I tried to get published for about a year, and that didn't happen. And so it's like, God, what do you want me to do for work? I know you want me to work. And the phone started to ring, and I started to get some little scrappy consulting projects, and I started doing those. And here I am 25 years later, that became a whole new career. God wanted me to be an independent consultant, and that's what I've been doing. And for 25 years, I've been consulting with small businesses almost entirely in Atlanta and giving my life away to people. I do about half and half of that. And it's been an incredible blessing to me. So that's the second big area God's changed is my whole work life. Never saw that coming. And the third area, on an even bigger scale, is just my life purpose and vision that God's given me. You know, my life purpose had been centered on success in my work and family. I remember the counselor at one point saying, Rob, what are your goals? And I said, I want to have success in my work, and I want to be married and have a family. And, you know, smart counselor, I don't know, where are you trying to get to? He was going to try to help me get there. So that's where I was targeted. But as a new Christian, Jesus got my attention with something else and really shifted that. As a new Christian, Jesus' words in Matthew 28 really stood out to me. It's where he says, go, it's right before he goes to heaven. He's got his followers gathered. In Matthew 28, he says, go make disciples of all nations, right? And I thought to myself, those sound like some really important words. I'm a big picture, strategic kind of a thinker. And here a man, he's about to go away from his followers. Those last words, you got to pay attention to those. Those are some big things going down. Just like the night before he was arrested, John 14, 15, 16, 17, those are some big things dropping there. You got to pay attention. So right before he goes, go and make disciples. What does that mean? And I was going to this church. I was like, okay, what does it mean to make disciples? I looked around. The only thing I could see was they had a Bible study called Disciple. It was a 34-week Bible study. And I thought, okay, maybe that's it. Maybe I can learn what it means to make disciples. I got into that. Great Bible study. Learned a lot, but I concluded, no. That's not what Jesus meant. There's something else. I didn't know. I mean, has this gone away? What do people do with this making disciples business? And I met a guy at the church named John, and he invited me to a breakfast. And it was a CBMC breakfast, and there was a small group of guys, and they were talking about sharing their faith with other people and making disciples. And it's like, maybe these guys know what it means. So I started hanging around them, and they were challenging one another, you know, in these things, and I started to feel kind of challenged by that. But I thought to myself, you know, before I make a disciple, I think maybe someone needs to meet with me. So I just prayed. I said, you know, God, I don't know how you're going to do this, but will you send someone into my life to help me, to who could disciple me? And it was just a few weeks later. I went to that same breakfast, and there was a guy I met named Dave. And I shook his hand, and as I shook his hand that morning, I just felt like God said, this is the guy you've been praying for. And I'd spent enough time around Dave where, to me, he was truly a spiritual giant. And I thought to myself, there is no way that this guy would have time for a loser like me. Not going to happen. And I dismissed it. But God worked it out, and I started spending some time with him. And before I knew it, you know, Dave and I started meeting regularly. And so that was the year I came to Christ. I started meeting with Dave. God provided him. And what a blessing Dave's been. He became a friend who cared for me. He taught me the Bible. He helped me see my life in the scriptures. What a gift that was. He opened his home to me. I've had so many meals with him and his wife, Judy, over the years. He's someone who became someone who I could confide in, my deepest secrets, my sin, my greatest struggles. And, you know, Dave, he's a broken man, I came to realize, just like me and you. But he modeled a biblical life for me that I started to emulate. And it was really the life of Jesus. And Dave, as he shared his life with me, God used him to show me a purpose for my life and a whole new vision of what my life would be about, of how I could participate in Jesus' calling to make disciples and to reach out to lost people. So that's where my life really got launched with this whole new purpose and vision. So it's been 28 years since I accepted the Lord's forgiveness and entered into the relationship with him. And he has made so many amazing changes in my life. But probably the one that's the most significant to me is the peace. So simple, the peace that he gave me. I've been through a lot of hard times over these 28 years, but his peace has never left me. And as I start to wrap up here, I just want to ask you to search your heart and ask yourself, do you have inner peace? Truly, do you have that inner peace? Do you have the peace? The Bible calls it a peace that passes all human understanding. You can't even understand it. I'm not talking about a peace that is situational, depending on how things are going, but it endures, especially when things get tough. Peace is right there with you. And if you don't have it, are you looking for it? And if you are looking for it, where are you looking for it? Think about that. Are you looking for it in your marriage or in a relationship? Or maybe like me, in your work or in your career? Maybe it's in your health and your well-being, your financial situation, your investments. Maybe it's in religion. There's so many places that we look for it. If you are looking in those other places, the obvious question is, how is that working for you? Is it working for you? Does God have more for you? I know a lot of people who have this peace, and they have found it in different ways. Their stories are all different, but it all comes from the same source. And I'm only aware of one source of true lasting peace, and that is Jesus Christ. Jesus said, "Come to me, all of you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls." You'll find that peace. That verse starts out by him saying, "Come to me." This is an invitation that he has for each one of us to get to know him and to have intimacy with him and to find rest, to come to him and to receive his forgiveness that he has for us. As we go through this week, I'm going to wrap up all my talks with some specific points of application of how you can practically apply what I'm talking about. And tomorrow, you're going to get a handout, and the ones I'm about to share with you will be in there along with for the other talks. My application for today is that the first step in giving your life to God is to realize that he's given his life for you and to accept that free gift of forgiveness. And all that is required to do that is faith. You cannot do anything. Just believe that he gave his life for you on the cross, that you have sin, that he gave his life for you on the cross, and accept his gift of forgiveness, his grace, his peace. Come to Jesus. This is where it all begins, in giving your life to God. And for those of you who are in Christ already, but perhaps for some reason you've drifted, you've lost your focus on him, that happened to the Corinthians, some of the Corinthians. Paul writes in 2 Corinthians 11 to people who have kind of drifted away from Jesus. And listen to what Paul says. He says, "I'm afraid that you've been deceived, that your minds have been led astray from your sincere and pure devotion to Christ." If that's you, if you've drifted from a sincere and pure devotion to Christ, maybe you've kind of overcomplicated it. That's one of the most amazing things about what I'm talking about, is the simplicity of this message. I went and visited a cousin in Los Angeles a few weeks ago who is in hospice. She's on her deathbed. She's a year older than me. And she's been an alcoholic all these years. I felt the Lord said, go. And I went. I didn't know if she would be in her right mind when I got there, but I was able to communicate with her. And I said, I held her hand, and I told her about the two thieves on the cross. And I told her how the one thief, he knew what he'd done was wrong. And in a moment, at the very end of his life, he put his faith in Jesus. He said, and Jesus said to him, today you'll be with me in paradise. It was just simple faith. And I shared that with my cousin. And her reaction was so interesting. She said, it just seems too simple. It seems too simple. And I said, Carol, that's how much God loves us. He made it so simple for us. And maybe you have strayed from a simple and pure devotion to Jesus. Maybe you've overcomplicated it. You've gotten tangled up and you've gotten deceived. Jesus says to you, come to me. That's the message. Come to me. Are you weary? You're burdened? Come to me and I'll give you rest. He stands with open arms at all times for every single one of us, no matter what we've done. If you've been a really, quote, bad person like me, or maybe you've been a really, quote, good person. I know people like that. And Jesus can be such a mystery. Well, you've got a sin problem too, right? And Jesus says, come to me. It's the most amazing, unconditional invitation that we could ever know. So I encourage you, no matter where you are, and I know for me, I feel like I'm in a good place with the Lord. I keep coming to him all the time. And I say, oh, Lord, I need you. And he's always there for me, just like he is for you. Looking forward to a great week with you guys, and thanks so much.
Thank you, Rob. Thank you very much. Quick announcements, then we're going off to lunch in the Gather Kids. Over to the left against the wall, there's a low table. I encourage you to check it out. There's also a sign-up sheet for all the recreational activities this week. So please take your time to do that, to take a look at that. It's very important. Tonight here in the main hall at 7 o'clock is game night. It's a lot of fun, so if, please come down and join us. Again, there's not really an agenda here, just rest, okay? You don't have to come. You can go to lunch and go take a nap, walk around, just rest. Sam Tischler asked me to remind guys that they're at 6 o'clock tomorrow morning here in the main hall. There'll be some prayer time. So if you're motivated, you know, think about it, come on down and join Sam for that. Ice cream is tomorrow night. Just going from memory, that's pretty important. I'm going to have exactly one teaspoonful, right? She and her mom are holding me accountable. So that's it. Anything else I've left out, Gary? We're good? Okay. Enjoy your lunch. You're free this afternoon. Have a great time here at the ranch.